You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved.
Being underwritten by Blake and Ulig and Teamsters Joint Council 56. Since 1972, Blake and Ulig has prided itself on providing comprehensive legal representation to labor organizations and their affiliated benefit funds on a local, regional, and national basis. Teamsters Joint Council 56 and our 9 local unions represent 30,000 workers, retirees, and their families in western Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska. We are proud to support the Heartland Labor Forum and their commitment to give working families a voice in the greater Kansas City community. The Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. Tonight on the Heartland Labor Forum, the Trump administration wants to redefine who is poor. Experts say they want to disappear the poor. We'll find out about it tonight. Then, Mark Muro, Brookings Institute, will talk to us about wealth work. That's the growing number of jobs in what's called the new servant economy. In the news, the Heartland Labor Forum sweeps media contest of the International Labor Communications Association, and will the United Auto Workers members ratify the deal with General Motors? Our feature at the end of the show is Community Voice Interview. And now for the news. And now for the news from our side. This is from the Detroit Free Press. Over the next few days, some 46,000 UAW members at General Motors will vote whether to ratify or reject a 2019 tentative contract agreement. Already, the limited results appear favorable for ratification, but it's still too early. So far, Local 160, which represents 1,335 workers at GM's Tech Center in Warren, Michigan, voted Sunday for the tentative agreement by 85% for it. Local 668, with 476 union workers at GM's Saginaw Metal Casting Operations Plant, voted with 73% in skilled trades and 75% of production workers that voted for the ratification. About 1,500 workers at GM's Toledo Transmission also voted to ratify by 80%. But the 3,300 workers in Spring Hill, Tennessee, narrowly rejected it 51-49%. The UAW International will release the official results after 3 p.m. Friday. We're now in the sixth week of the strike, which will continue until a yes ratification vote. In These Times interviewed Rihanna Shoemaker, who works at the GM Customer Care After Sales. It's Parts Depot in Pennsylvania. Rihanna opposes ratification, saying the manufacturing plants got rid of tiers after a few years, and everyone moves up to the same pay scale of $32.32 an hour if you're not a temp. Even in the GM components holding plants, where they make certain parts, they are all on the same pay scale, but that pay scale is lower. You only max at $22.50 after 8 years there, which she thinks is just wrong. At Rihanna's Parts Depot called CCA, there are multiple pay scales. Tier 1 people have been there forever. They have pensions. They max out at $31.57. With this new contract, the scale below them, which we call Tier 2, they max out at around the same pay, but they don't get a pension. That's a big difference between them now. You can consider me Tier 3, which they call in progression. It takes me 8 years to max out. My max rate is $25, but we are in the same building doing the exact same work. At these other buildings, they're all in the same building doing the same work with the same pay scale, but not here. There are different pay scales that go all the way down to temps, but if you take them all, there are 4 tiers. We're still not considered one whole union, like we're all not equal. She's voting no. She said, it's just not a good contract. You can say that you want the ratification bonus. Yeah, they're giving us $11,000. They're giving the temps $4,500 just to sign the contract. That's a one-time deal. That's just not good enough. I don't even want to look at that. If you take that out of the equation, then the rest of the contract is lousy.
The Heartland Labor Forum is again celebrating our wins in the International Labor Communications Association Labor Media Awards for programs we produced in 2018. In the category of Best Audio Podcast, Radio Broadcast, we won first and second place and an honorable mention. First place went to the show called The Attack on Public Employee Workers and Unions and How They're Resisting, produced by Chris Mann, member of AFT Local 691. Second place went to Kim Claus and Sean Sobbing for a show called Eric Loomis, A History of America in 10 Strikes and Undoing Missouri's Public Sector. The honorable mention went to Judy Ansel for her show on Prop A, How We Defeated Right to Work. The awards will be given out at the International Labor Communications Convention November 14th and 15th at the Tommy Douglas Conference Center in Silver Spring, Maryland. To listen to any of these shows, go to heartlandlaborforum.org.
After a Republican tax bill was signed into law, AT&T brought in $163 billion in revenue and made $13 billion in profit. Instead of sharing their prosperity with workers, they used these profits to reward and enrich their shareholders and investors through stock buyouts. But that wasn't enough for billionaire hedge fund CEO Paul Singer. Singer's firm, Elliott Management, which now owns 1% of AT&T, publicly demanded last month that the company outsource jobs, close corporate retail stores, and divest key assets to make a short-term profit for shareholders off the backs of workers, which would weaken the company in the long term. Unfortunately, AT&T seems to be listening to Singer's demands. Last week, the company laid out plans to sell Puerto Rico and U.S. Virgin Island assets to Liberty Latin America, a company with a history of union busting and job cuts. This is the first step in Singer's campaign to get AT&T to cut jobs and sell assets for quick cash. A recent report done by Communication Workers of America showed how 30,000-plus family-supporting jobs could be at risk if Singer is successful.
PAI reports the government employees, AFGE, the nation's largest union for federal workers, has summarized and is publishing, in five installments, a secret Trump administration memo outlining in detail how GOP President Donald Trump and his ideologues systematically plan to destroy federal worker unions. AFGE adds in its own analysis, and private sector workers and unions are next on Trump's hit list, the memo promises. The memo by Trump White House aide James Shirk, a former fellow at the Hard Right Heritage Foundation, is being posted and analyzed on AFGE's website. It includes restoring GOP President George W. Bush's ban on unionization of the nation's 45,000 airport screeners, and that's just for starters. It would also ban unions for the Defense Department's 200,000 civilian workers, the hundreds of thousands of workers at the Department of Veterans Affairs, and workers at the Department of Homeland Security, and the Federal Office of Personnel Management, the government's human resources agency itself. Trump also wants to abolish OPM. Killing OPM and transferring its oversight of federal workers to unaccountable White House aides would bring back the spoil system of the 1880s and before, union leaders said. The memo, laced with familiar half-truths and outright lies, is proof AFGE has been right along in saying that the administration's true goal in making changes to personnel rules is to end collective bargaining in the federal sector. It's right there in their own words, the union says. It also goes far beyond Trump's prior executive orders trashing federal worker rights.
News Tonight was read by Keith Washburn and myself, Chris Mann. Our introductory words spoken by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speaking about poverty.
We read one day, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty, and the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists. Estimated that we spend $322,000 for each enemy we kill in Vietnam, while we spend in the so-called war on poverty in America only about $53 for each person classified as poor. The promises of the Great Society have been shot down on the battlefield of Vietnam, making the poor, white and Negro, bear the heaviest burdens both at the front and at home.
The other thing I want you to understand is this, that it didn't cost the nation one penny to integrate lunch counters. It didn't cost the nation one penny to guarantee the right to vote. But now we are dealing with issues that cannot be solved without the nation spending billions of dollars and undergoing a radical redistribution of economic power.
Yes, yes.
All labor has dignity.
Yes.
But you are doing another thing. You are reminding not only Memphis, but you are reminding the nation that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages. America's opportunity to help bridge the gulf between the haves and the have-nots. And the question is whether America will do it. There's nothing new about poverty. What is new is that we now have the techniques and the resources to get rid of poverty. And the real question is whether we have the will.
I'd like to welcome everybody to the Heartland Labor Forum. My name is Chris Mann, and I'm the host for this program. Tonight, our guests are Alice Kitchen, a local activist, Frank Lenk, the Mid-America Regional Council, or he's from MARC. The Mid-America Regional Council is Kansas City area's Metropolitan Planning Organization, or MPO, and Council of Governments. In addition to standard MPO responsibilities for transportation planning, MARC manages programs that provide human services to older adult populations and to preschool children and their families, as it is also the area agency for aging and Head Start. They provide the grants for counties on the Missouri side of our region. So welcome, Alice and Frank. I'm going to ask, I want to call on Alice of why we're having this program.
Background on this program was that in early May, I saw a notice in the New York Times about the Office of Management and Budget proposing a change to the poverty level, and that concerned me a lot, so I started calling around to the Missouri Budget Project. I called around to NETWORK, my national organization, social justice lobby group in D.C. Anyway, then we pulled up the notice, actually, from OMB saying that they were requesting comments regarding a possible change to the way that inflation is calculated. And so this is very alarming to me, and so that's why I contacted Frank, and Frank can tell us why this is so significant.
So I guess that's my cue.
That is your cue.
So there's multiple ways to calculate inflation, which goods and services you include, and then how you relate those changes over time. And the Office of Management and Budget was proposing what looked like a very technical change to move from keeping a sort of a standard market basket more or less fixed to one that allows for substitution of goods and services over time. As prices go up, people will buy a cheaper good rather than the more expensive good. And it sounds perfectly reasonable from a 100,000-foot view if you're an economist, but the fact of the matter is what the practical effect is that it lowers the rate at which the poverty threshold increases. And so that means we would count fewer people as poor in the future than we do today. And that has impacts for how many people would be eligible for things like food stamps and Medicaid. And so it has the effect of lowering the number of people that we would have otherwise counted in the future as being poor and so eligible for benefits compared to the current standard. And because of that, as Alice said, it's alarming because fewer people will be able to get the help that they need.
So have these changes gone through officially, or this agency is asking for comment?
They had a 90-day period open for comments, and people did respond. I know from our city we had... the city of Kansas City responded with a 5-page letter. Johnson County United Community Services got it immediately, responded. A number of organizations signed on to existing Missouri Budget Project letter. JWJ did respond, and numerous other organizations. What they immediately grasped was that this will change the people we work with, the people that matter to our city, to our programs, and that their eligibility for certain programs will be less. The city of Kansas City may have a different threshold, and that may affect the money coming into the city, and that's an area that Frank is certainly much more conversant than I am.
So I think we have Dr. Bruce Eddy, who just joined us. Welcome, Dr. Eddy.
Thank you.
Well, you are the executive director of the Jackson County Mental Health Tax Fund. How did you get interested in this change,
changes? It's critical for the whole county and for people that receive mental health care that are not able to afford insurance. So the potential effects of this are huge for a lot of people in Jackson County. That's what got me involved.
So how do people relate to these changes? Is it a democratic process? Can people, do we have to accept this? And it's going to make, as I'm gathering here, it's going to make less poor people on paper, but not in reality.
Right. Well, it's an administrative change rather than a legislative change. And so without some kind of intervention, I'm expecting that we'll have to live with this in the short term. I think you heard there was some discussion a few minutes ago, and I didn't hear it very clearly, but the question had been posed, has this happened? And I think that that's really important, that it's not a transparent process. And I'm not sure whether it's happened or not. And if it has, it may not be something that we know about right away. So the whole process is concerning. And, for me personally, and I guess to an extent professionally, this is just something that's part of the present administration. There's a lot of drama. There's a lack of certainty around a lot of important policy decisions. So is it something that that we have to put up with? I think this is going to become a matter for the legislature if this actually goes through.
So I did try to check online to see whether there had been any guidance issued to agencies about this change being implemented. I didn't see anything, so it could still be under review, or maybe that guidance hasn't been written yet. But it is as Dr. Eddy said, an administrative change that can be implemented. They've gone through the process of seeking public comment, and now they're going to reach a decision.
But Frank, specifically, how will this affect the cities and the counties if it goes through?
Well, I mean, it does shift the burden of taking care of the poor from the federal government to the cities and counties. Mm-hmm. And of course, they're already overstretched with trying to take care of the indigent poor, either through either health care needs or housing, utility assistance, all the other things that poor people face, transportation, child care, and so on. And so either they come up with additional resources and shift them from other parts of the budget, or they don't, and the need gets worse, and people end up in more emergency situations as opposed to sort of in relatively stable situations.
Are the local governments prepared for this?
I would say that they are concerned about it. I don't know that they've made any specific preparations. I've not heard of anything at this point.
What steps would your agencies take if these were going to be the new guidelines?
Well, I think it's a budgeting issue, and so what are the additional supports that they can provide to, number one, help people find and get jobs so that they aren't below poverty or have better sustaining income. There's a certain class of folks for whom that's a possibility, but there's other folks for whom, the cost of getting a slightly better paying job means that they lose all their benefits, and so it'll be harder for them to make that adjustment. And so if it's a budgeting issue, then it's a priority issue. And so what are the services the local governments are going to shift resources to? My guess, the roads need to be repaired. Police officers need to be paid. So it is more likely to fall on the backs of the poor to struggle through. Morally, that's a reprehensible situation.
And I think Alice wants to contribute some information she discovered.
And I didn't know if Bruce, did you have anything to add to Frank's comments?
Dr. Eddy, did you have anything?
Yes, I heard my name, but I didn't hear much. Okay. I can barely hear Alice. I'm sorry.
Anything to add to what Frank Link said?
Well, I see the same sets of factors, and I think that the question was a good one: is are cities and counties prepared for this? And I think there are so many priorities just to maintain our infrastructure and basic public services. It's hard to see how there's room to do much more. I think the stuff that I would add is basically on the potential impacts. One of the things about Kansas City is the very, very high eviction rate. It's, I believe, in the top 10 nationally. And so when we start to do things that further erode the safety net, that eviction rate's going to increase. And from the work that we've done here in my office and plenty of other places too, we know that the impacts of requiring struggling families to be highly mobile are devastating. So when we reduce the poverty rate, that impacts the level of services. It causes people to have less stability, and it's got long-term decrements to the well-being of children that are potentially generational.
So I was, in preparation for this program, I contacted Jeanette Mott-Oxford with Empower Missouri, who wrote a very strong letter, impassioned letter, and she happened to be, she couldn't be with us, but she was in D.C., is in D.C., and she talked to Liz Scott of the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, and the latest is that 50,000 comments were received on OMB poverty measure proposal, overwhelmingly against the proposed change. No further action by Trump administration yet. That's the latest.
That's great news.
I just want to add that, by all indications, the poor face a higher inflation rate than the general public because of things like health care and housing are such a big part of their budgets, and the inflation rate on those things are much higher than just the average inflation rate. And yet this is a proposal to reduce the rate of inflation on the poor to below what is the average. And so that just doesn't make any sense.
And we are unfortunately out of time. We'd like to thank our guests tonight, Dr. Bruce Eddy, Frank Link, and Alice Kitchen. We'll close on this thought, words spoken by Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, on the International Day dedicated to the eradication of poverty. He said, "On this day, recommit to think, decide, and act together against extreme poverty and plan for a world where no one is left behind. Our aim must be prosperity for all and not for just a few." I'm pleased to say that our guests tonight have agreed to return on November 14th to dive into this topic of the disappearing poor, Part 2. You won't want to miss it. Stay tuned for our next segment with Mark Morrow of Brookings Institute. He will talk to us about wealth work. That's the growing number of jobs in what's called the new servant economy. Thank you for listening to this segment as we transition to the next half of the Heartland Labor Forum. We'll listen to Miss V's song called Poverty. Miss V, she is a singer from Ghana. Her music contains elements of Afro-pop, R&B, and dancehall, and her strong vocal abilities earned her a nomination for Female Vocalist of the Year at the 2015 Ghana Music Awards.
Miss V. Children, no, we say that in time we're taking control. What I know about the volunteers at KKFI is that we're quirky, cool, stubborn, intelligent, on edge, and heartfelt. We come from various parts of Missouri and Kansas to nurture this thing that we all hold so dear. And I believe it's because we can all be heard here, and that's what makes us so beautiful. So if you're listening and you're a KKFI volunteer, know that you are so very deeply appreciated for keeping community radio alive.
This is federal worker Kenneth Bate of the Social Security Administration, and I encourage all of my federal worker friends to support KKFI 90.1 FM during the combined federal campaign. Donating a few dollars each pay period can help keep community radio on the air in Kansas City. Designate your tax-deductible donation to KKFI CFC Agency Code 21994. Thank you for supporting community radio.
Did you know your business or organization could be sponsoring this or any of your other favorite KKFI programs? Learn more at kkfi.org/marketing.
Journalism is under attack as the American media is subverted by propaganda. Join David Barsamian with the presentation where he exposes efforts of repressive governments to silence media on October 30th at 6:30 p.m. at the Old Souls Church, 4501 Walnut, Kansas City. David is the producer of alternative radio heard here on KKFI. Tickets are available at Brown Paper Tickets or at the door. And for more information, go to ourfcm.org. The public service announcement of KKFI 90.1 FM.
And welcome back to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Sean Saving. By now, we're all familiar with the hollowing out of the U.S. labor market. Whether you're a data wonk or just a regular working stiff, it's apparent that stable, decent-paying middle-class jobs, be they in the factory or at the office, are becoming harder and harder to find. In contrast, job growth of highly skilled work at the top end of the pay scale and routine service-level work at the low end continues to be robust, outpacing the growth of jobs in the middle. But one sector of the service industry is growing faster than all others, one that is becoming more commonly referred to as wealth work. Long-standing occupations like house cleaners, manicurists, and landscapers, but also newer jobs like dog walkers, fitness trainers, and personal chefs are on the rise. While middle-class households may employ these services from time to time, the demand is largely coming from those in the upper 20% of incomes. Poor people working for rich people is nothing new, of course, but the relationship between the employer and the worker have changed greatly since the times of Downton Abbey. Rather than being formal employees with stable pay and basic job protections guaranteed by law, a large portion of the workers in this new servant economy are independent contractors who have no benefits like sick leave or health insurance and who do not qualify for even unemployment insurance or workers' compensation. To learn more about this new segment of the economy and what can be done to make this work better, I spoke with Mark Murrow, the senior fellow at Brookings Institution, via phone earlier this week. Here's the interview. Mr. Murrow, welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me on.
Regarding the current labor market, you write about something called the U-shaped employment curve. Can you briefly explain what you mean by that?
The U-shaped curve is a depiction of the fact that thanks to a variety of factors, including globalization especially and automation, we've seen the middle of the labor market hollow out. Many formerly decent paying, numerous middle skill, middle pay jobs have actually disappeared as globalization allowed some of those jobs to be sent abroad or technology replaced them. So jobs that were sort of mechanical or rote or rule based have been taken over often by either robots or now software in the office. And so the middle of the job description's fallen out. You're left with fast growth at the high end and actually growth in jobs at the bottom.
So this is the rich are getting richer and the middle class is sort of shrinking kind of phenomenon, right? So these new jobs at the bottom are what a lot of people are calling the personal service work. Is that how you would describe it? And what kind of jobs
are those?
Yeah,
that's pretty much what has happened. We had a decent base of fairly well-paying middle-skill jobs, often accessible to people for people without a college education, who could work in a factory or work doing kind of bureaucratic work, process work in companies, and make a decent living, have a middle-class life. That is not true now, as technology and globalization has replaced that work, and many of those people have been pushed into lower-end service work.
And some of this stuff is sort of has traditional employers. You know, you get your landscapers, house cleaners, etc. But, a lot of this is being done now by people who are considered to be independent contractors. Where is the demand for these services coming from?
Yeah, well, we have often called this work wealth work because it often has a dimension of catering to the whims and consumer needs and comfort of the well-off. But maybe that's somewhat unfair. A large swath of the country is ordering things out, ordering food in, having somebody come to walk the dog while they go for a three-day vacation, and so on. And even things like fitness trainers are not necessarily catering only to the wealthy. But one thing that cuts across all this is increased use of on-demand platforms to make this efficient. So you have the proliferation of what we call the Uber for X everything economy, in which you can you have services for people doing chores, services doing errands, services like DoorDash delivering food, and all of this caters to the kind of on-demand consumer lifestyle that is really spread in the country, especially among the wealthy. But I think the middle class and upper middle class are increasingly driving this.
And you found that there's, in fact, some relationship, geography. These jobs are not evenly spread across the country, though. They're sort of concentrated in these higher income, wealthier cities. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. It's an interesting geography. You would expect wealth work to be extensive where the wealthy live, and so the list of high pay, booming, tech-driven or coastal wealth hubs, the Bostons, the New Yorks, the Miamis, the Seattles, the Bay Area, San Diego, L.A., are big centers of this. But also interesting are another group of places where, sort of often beach communities, the Hilton Heads of the world, where the wealthy and the upper middle class vacation.
Tourism support is a big part of this sector, right?
Yeah, I would say, we did not formally count that because tourism has become at this point, very spread across the economy, but absolutely, it's the same dynamic. And it has some of the same features of, relatively low-pay work, catering to fairly well-off clients.
Right. What's also interesting about this segment is that although it's also not geographically spread across the country evenly, it's also these workers don't really look like the overall labor force.
While it is certainly true that all kinds of workers in all kinds of demographic groups populate this sort of on-demand, online, wealth work segment, it's heavily tilted towards, on the one hand, women, and on the other hand, Latinos. So if you could think of some of the categories such as gardening or landscaping, maid work, heavily tilted towards Latinos. And then, other things like shampooers, manicurists, are hairdressers, heavily oriented towards women.
The hollowing out of the labor market is often blamed on automation and the loss of routine manual work,
which, you know, thanks to unionization movements of the mid-20th century, made these jobs sort of decent-paying middle-class occupations. Rather than the increase in personal service work being merely a result of people looking for new work anywhere they can get it, I've come across arguments that say that automation is actually directly contributing to this increase in these service, personal service type, non-routine manual work. What's the relationship there between automation in our factories and throughout the rest of society and this rise in this personal service sector?
First, automation should be understood as including, on the one hand, highly manual factory work, you know, expressed by robots, but also massive amounts of routine, rule-based process work in corporations and bureaucracies. In both cases, though, robots on the one hand or enterprise software, basically, you know, computers in the office world, have replaced tens of millions of workers. They have been pushed into jobs that are durable but turn out to be terribly paid and have few benefits in our country. So you have a whole swath of both factory workers and office workers who had middle-class lifestyles 25 years ago have been now shoved into a whole tier of what we call wealth work and related other kinds of service work.
Well, and this this automation wave has also been part of why the top quintile, the top 20%, have gotten a lot wealthier, right? And that is what's somewhat driving. They have more free, they have more disposable income to spend on luxury items like a personal cook or personal stylists or you know, shop person shops for you. That's related to this, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there, many of us have pointed out that the investment in capital in the form of robots and computers represents a transfer often from labor to capital. So that in itself is driving a transfer of wealth upwards. And then, as you're saying, the specific ways that, you know, time and money are spent, these technologies do drive productivity and do create economic benefits for some while replacing work of others. So they certainly do have the effect that you described.
And I guess one pro of this kind of work is, since it's face-to-face work, it's not easily outsourced to a person in, you know, a person in India can't do your shopping for you. They're not going to be able to walk your dog. But then again, on the other hand, since these are kind of luxury items, I guess when the next recession comes along or maybe more aggressive tax policy from a different administration towards the rich, it might seem like these folks might be at a disadvantage when people start to say, hey, maybe I can't, don't need to spend money on that.
Yeah, my bet is that this work will not go away. I think, you know, the well-off are pretty well insulated no matter what happens. And meanwhile, the technologies in place that allow for this on-demand work and on-demand search for service will continue. So I'm not worried about that. I think it's going to continue. Even a downturn will leave demand fairly in place. Though it's true, maybe those in the more upper middle class for whom this is maybe more a consumer nicety may see it wane. And so that's why you know, I think it's important to consider how we make these better jobs.
You are listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Sean Saving, and I'm talking about the rise of wealth work with Mark Moreau, senior fellow at the Brookings Institute. So, since it would appear that personal service work is not going anywhere, you've called for making this work better for employees, or workers, since they're not technically employees a lot of times. Given how hard it is proven to be to organize these kinds of workers in the past, it seems unlikely that unionization and collective bargaining will lead to better pay and working conditions anytime soon. Instead, you call for several policy changes that could help this segment of the labor force. Can you briefly explain some of these things you'd like to see the government step in and do?
We think one of the problems here is the conditions and the rules and the legal structures under which wealth work occurs. We've always had wealth work. Think of Downton Abbey, right? What has become, you know, difficult is, you know, that the protections and the work rules have really eroded. And so there's often little regulation of the hours under and schedules under which people work. They're on demand, so often subjected to very rough schedules. The pay is not good. Benefits are often non-existent. So in that sense, the question may be, this work is going to be with us. Much of it, as you've said, is the kind of work that will survive the robots. So the task becomes, can we make these better jobs? Because for some, they are useful jobs and important jobs.
If you can't organize and you're at the will of the market when it comes to how much you can get paid, what are ways we can improve the salaries or the wages or just the amount of money that people who are doing these jobs have? And I've heard things about the earned income tax credit. There's also issues regarding the tipped minimum wage and how that applies. Could you talk about those a little bit?
One fact here is that wealth work pays very badly. You know, we're talking like $36,000 a year on average, often inconsistent hours and so on. So there are some basic things, you know, obviously minimum wage makes a lot of sense in many places. The earned income tax credit, remains important, and a fully refundable child tax credit would be helpful. And then I think much of this involves tipped work. So getting a tipped minimum wage, eliminating the tip minimum wage may be an important factor for, you know, workers like cosmetologists and such.
And just to explain to our listeners, that's the fact that tipped workers oftentimes in most states do not have to be paid the full minimum wage if their tips make up the difference between, say, 50% the minimum wage, where the limit is the federal level, makes the full minimum wage, there is no need for the employer to pay higher than this, what's called the tipped minimum wage. So you're saying if we got rid of that and said minimum wage is minimum wage, period.
Well, this is, you know, and many of the kinds of occupations we're talking about are subject to those conditions. So the agenda should become attempting to make these into better jobs, because the work is likely not going away and, you know, millions of people rely on them.
And benefits would be the other thing. It seems to me that some kind of universal health care, expanded access to health care, whether it be expanded Medicaid, Obamacare working better than it currently does, that would be a big policy level improvement that could help out low-wage workers across the board, not just these workers.
These jobs frequently lack employer-provided health care. And in fact, you know, I think we're seeing that linking health and other crucial benefits to the work provider is often a recipe for insecurity. So this is where strengthening a, you know, national, consistent, dependable, high-quality health system is absolutely central. But then you can get into things like retirement and paid leave benefits. Some states are beginning to experiment with that. There's been experiments with automatic IRAs, which, you know, give retirement payroll deductions to all workers, including ones, especially ones that don't enjoy retirement plans.
The approach here would be that when a person, say, pulls up their app and calls up a ride for one of these ride-sharing services, part of what they're paying has to go into a fund that then contributes to these workers' benefits. I mean, for example, these workers don't even have unemployment insurance or workers' comp. So even though they're an independent contractor, the person who hires them at that moment is still paying something into that fund for these workers. Is that how something like that would work?
There are numerous experiments beginning on this, and clearly this is where you can add to the label wealth work much broader swaths of work, such as, you know, large portions of the gig economy. You know, Uber and Lyft drivers, you know, are on the front edge of this, operating without the basic benefits. We think that, the wealth work piece of this is a disturbing and interesting part of the story, but we're really talking about a broad array of responses for a really broad way of workers.
Well, Mr. Murrow, thank you very much for your time with us today. I appreciate your insights.
Great.
We're going to put some links to your reports on our webpage.
Really appreciate the time to talk about this, and look forward to staying in touch.
That was Mark Murrow, Senior Fellow from the Brookings Institute. We were talking about wealth work.
Community Voices is a production of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It is our way of letting the voices of our neighbors be heard. Any opinions and views expressed are those of the speakers only, and not necessarily those of Midcoast Radio Project, KKFI, board, staff, or volunteers.
Hi, I'm Judy Ansel. You may recognize my voice from the Heartland Labor Forum, Thursdays at 6 p.m. here on KKFI. Or, if you're the type to get up at the crack of dawn, you can catch us at 5 a.m. on Fridays. Besides labor radio, I have another passion. That's international human rights, and specifically, global labor rights. And I live that passion through our local nonprofit, the Cross Border Network, or CBN. CBN started out after NAFTA to connect working people in Kansas City with workers in the export factories just across the border with Mexico. Back before 9/11 and the drug wars, that's in the 1990s, we connected workers from GM and Ford, Zenith and LG in Korea, and even Hallmark with workers in Mexico to see that, in fact, they had common interests and the Mexicans don't steal their jobs. Employers do. One thing we noticed when we spent a lot of time on the border was that families working there had to send some members to the U.S. because our corporations there didn't pay a living wage. That's when we learned that there's a connection between U.S. policies and migration. The last few years, we've focused our work on Honduras, where the human rights violations are greater and the pay is less than in Mexico. We've worked in Honduras since 2009, when there was a U.S.-sponsored coup that overthrew a democratically elected government and replaced it with what has become a dictatorship. We've watched as U.S. policies have actually created a situation where more and more people cannot stand to live there anymore and are leaving. So we've done many things. We've taken delegation after delegation to investigate one atrocity or another there. We've looked at land theft by tourist corporations. We've looked at mining interests. We've looked at collateral damage from the drug war. People have been killed with our guns, our guys, and our policies. And we've pressured our government to stop. So the Cross Border Network is very political. We say we support workers across borders and workers who cross borders. We put on informational events. We take delegations to Latin America, which, by the way, are very safe and well chaperoned. We pressure Congress, and particularly our local members of Congress. And we participate with the rest of the immigrant rights movement here in Kansas City to try to ensure that we are safe and welcoming here in Kansas City, and that we don't, that our immigrants don't get their rights violated too much. So we do all of those things. Plus, of course, we are in favor of a number of pieces of legislation. So join us. Get on our mailing list. Email us at info@crossbordernetwork.org. Come to our meetings. Come to our events.
Thank you.
Is Judy Ansel for Community Voices on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
And now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar, October 24th, 2019. Update on workers' rights, sponsored by Heartland Alliance for Progress. Monday, October 28th, 5:15 to 7 p.m., 125 East 31st Street, Kansas City, Missouri. Rally for a Tenants' Bill of Rights, October 30th, 3 p.m. on the steps of City Hall, KCMO. Alternative Radio's David Barsamanian speaks in Kansas City, Wednesday, October 30th, 6:30 p.m. at All Souls UU Church, 4501 Walnut, KCMO. And there's a healthcare town hall Saturday, November 9th at 2 p.m. at Covenant Presbyterian Church on Swope Parkway, sponsored by Jobs with Justice. And thanks this week to our engineer, Keith Washburn. Stay tuned for the Thursday night special. Tonight we have River City Chautauqua.
Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.